Okay. Tonight is a very unique class. Tonight, we've already finished all of the actual individual letters of the Hebrew alphabet from Aleph all the way through Tav. We've covered them all. Many of them, we actually came across that there was a second version of that letter if it came at the end of a word. It's what we call the final letters. There are actually five of them. There's five final letters, and we're going to discuss them tonight and to really try to understand a concept about them. But I want to paint a picture for you. We as adults, or we as parents, we as grandparents, whatever, we as teachers, the power that we wield is unbelievably scary. I'll tell you why I say that. My grandchild, my granddaughter, who is about 5 years old, 5 and a half years old, was with us over Pesach, over Passover. And one morning, we're sitting and eating breakfast, just the two of us. My wife had made breakfast. It was great, wonderful. And I'm talking with her. And I say, Miri, that's her name, Miri, how do you spell your name in Hebrew? So she thinks for a moment and she says, Mem, Yud, Resh, Yud. Uh-oh, hold on, hold on. If I lose you, it's because my battery just went dead. Hold on, hold on.
He disappeared.
I forgot to plug it in.
Mem, Yud, and then we were in the middle.
Okay. Okay. Sorry. Mem Yud Resh Yud. Miri. That's how she would spell it. So I looked at her and I said, Miri, are you sure that's right? She says, Zadie, yes, it's Mem Yud Resh Yud. I said, no, it's not. She's taken all aback, like, oh, what do you mean? I learned it incorrectly. I said, no, it's Mem Yud Resh. And then a final yud. She says to me, final yud? There's no such letter, Zadie. Not true. Nuh-uh. I said, Miri, and I start winking. Miri, there's a final yud in your name. She laughs. You can see the light bulb go off in her head, like, okay, Zadie's playing with me now. I got this. And then she says, oh, your name also ends with a final yud. And she starts winking. Zadie ends with a final yud. And Bubby ends with a final yud. And she starts going through everybody in the family who ends with a final yud. So be very careful. Right before she left, I said to her, Miri, it's going to be our little joke, right? Don't tell your teacher that I told you this, please. So she's like, okay. This will be our secret, Zadie. So what are the five final letters? So I'm going to share with you, and I'll just tell you what all five are, but then we're going to really try to understand. And there's a piece of Talmud that puts it in perspective. There are the letters, not in this order, but listen to how I say it. It's Mem, Nun. There's a regular Mem and a final Mem. Nun. And a final nun, tzadi and final tzadi, pei and final pei, or fei, either one, and chaf and final chaf. Those are the five. And the acronym that I want you to memorize is called Minatzpach. I know it's a funny sounding name, but those are the five letters. Minatzpach. Mem, nun, tzadi, fei, chaf. Minatzpach. This is how the Talmud actually uses as an acronym to teach us about the five letters. So I want to share with you. The piece of Talmud is somewhat long, but we're going to highlight some critical pieces of this. The Talmud says as follows. Minatzpach tsofim amram. Do you know who taught us and ensured that we know these final letters? The people that were known as Sofim, Hebrew word Sofim, which literally mean watchmen, those who see and watch over something. They were the ones who God put in, so to say, the watchtower to ensure that these final letters and what they represent will be in place. I don't know about you, but that's very cryptic. The word sophim literally means to see, which in English we would call them seers, S-E-E-R-S, prophets of some sort. And that's true. But the Talmud is telling us something more, that they were called watchmen. They were watching over the concepts that these five letters represent. So the Talmud continues. Rabbi Elazar Omer, Rabbi Elazar says the following. Chamesh otiot nichpalu. There are five letters that get doubled, right? There's two different versions of them. Vikulan, and all five, lashon geula, are a reference to redemption. Okay, one second. We're given our first clue. What do we call these five letters? We call them in English, we call them final letters. Those that appear at the end of a word. Hint, hint. The Talmud says, there's a message. If you want to know about the end of an era, if you want to know about certain eras of history, when we go through various challenging times in our history, look to these five letters because they will spell the end. They will convey the message of finalization, reaching the end of an era and being moved on to the next. The Talmud continues. Am I coming in clear here? Because I see that it's unstable a little bit. Am I phasing in and out?
You keep freezing a little bit.
Sorry, I don't know. There's something going on in my internet today. Okay.
And I missed the entire story about your granddaughter because you kept breaking up. The entire story. I have three words.
Sorry, it wasn't that good. It's
you'll
okay.
Have to repeat it.
Okay.
We got the final yud, Zadie.
Right. More important is that you hear the message. Don't worry about my granddaughter. It's all good. Continues and says each one of these letters, as we will see in a moment, is a hint to a particular redemption that we had. So the Talmud continues and gives, for example, the letter Chaf, which is the first in chronological order, in alphabetical order, I should say. The Chaf is the first letter in the alphabet that's doubled. Says the Talmud, you know where that expression comes up? In the very beginning, when Abraham begins his initial journey away from his family, away from his homeland, away from his country, and he has to go on this journey where he doesn't know, but God will tell him, that begins with the famous expression, Lech Lecha, go for yourself. It is time to begin a journey. Says this piece of Talmud, listen to the word Lech Lecha. It's got the chafs. It's got, within a matter of two words, it has an emphasis on the chaf. Lech lecha. Go. Start a journey. Now I know Susan's begging to ask the question. It's also got an emphasis on the lamed.
No, I was going to go into the other chas. Me'artzacha.
Yes. That's correct. And there's an emphasis on the chaf, the final chaf, over and over and over again. This is the verse that the Talmud states is there to teach us double chaf. Our ancestor, our patriarch, Abraham, was redeemed from the Chaldees from way back that part of the world. And God told him, go for yourself. That epitomizes stage one of redemption for the Jewish nation. It wasn't even a full nation. We're going to go through all five, but I want to give you the overview. So the final chaf is the redemption of stage one regarding Abraham. The next one in alphabetical order is the double mem. Chaf, lamed, mem. What is the verse that's cited regarding mem? It's regarding our patriarch Isaac, Yitzchak, where after he was redeemed from the Philistines, He had this whole incident with them. Not a very pretty story. But at the end, he leaves based on the king's word. And the king says to him, Lech me'imanu, go away from amongst our, from us. Go from us. Ki atzamta, listen to the words, mimenu me'od. What sound do you hear? Mimenu me'od. You got a lot of m sounds in there. Says the Talmud, the double ups of the mems is to teach us that go from us because you are much mightier than us, is what the king of the Philistines said to Isaac. Says the Talmud, that represents stage two of redemption, the final mem. Then you come to the final or double nun, and that's with the patriarch Jacob. When he has his battle or soon to be battle with his brother Esau, he prays out to God and he uses the Hebrew word Hatzileni, next word, na. If you say it fast enough, it sounds exactly the way it should. Hatzileni na. No, 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 no. You hear the N sound. Says the Talmud that Jacob prays to God that God should save him. I ask of you, please save me from the hand of my brother. And he is in fact successful with that. Stage number three, redemption on third level. Then you come to the letter pay or fey. Where is this? This goes down to when we were redeemed from Egypt as a nation. If you recall, I know we spoke about it in one of our classes when we spoke about the letter pay. The word pay was alluding to the secret code that Joseph had told over before he died, that God will surely remember you. Pakod pakadati. God said, I will surely remember you and ultimately deliver you and take you out from this land. Stage number four, that's a reference to the Exodus. That's redemption stage four. Stage five is the letter Tzadi. Now, I personally like this one the most, maybe because my name begins with it and I can relate to it. But this is the coolest one of all. Why? Because this one is based on a verse that talks about the final redemption, the coming of the Messiah, Mashiach. The letter Tzadi is based on the fact that the verse in Zechariah, the prophet Zechariah, he says that he refers to, in telling over in God's name, he says, the man, hine, ish sameach, the man that sprouts, it's an important word, sameach is his name, a man whose name is a young shoot, and from below where he is, he shall grow, and he shall build the temple of God. This is from Zechariah chapter 6. Semach, yitzmach. It's a play again on the letter Tzadi. If this overwhelms you with the Hebrew, don't sweat it. What I want you to understand from this piece of Talmud is that the Talmud seems to understand that something about being a final letter is a reference to the concept of bringing a stage to its conclusion, leading to the next level. Where you go through that era, and there will come a conclusion to that stage as well. And we go through five stages. This is what the Talmud says. The redemption that God grants to his people will assume many different forms. We are not a one-dimensional people that have gone through a pretty simple journey through history. If anything can be said, we have had more ups and downs, more bumps in the road, moments of absolute glory, and moments of almost sheer desperation and despair. We have been on both ends of the extreme. This piece of Talmud is teaching us, and we're going to go through all five of the stages and to learn. All of what I'm sharing with you is based on an essay by Rav Hirsch, who you know I love dearly. I quote him very, very often. In one of his books that is called The Collected Writings of Rabbi Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, in one of his essays, is this talk, is this essay. Okay? So I want to share this with you. Give me 1 second. Everybody. Okay. All right, here we go. Okay. So let's go through each one and understand that the point that's being made about it is that each redemption, we learn a new phenomenon in history of how God reveals himself through the redemption of the Jewish people. That's really the message that I want you to walk away with tonight. Okay, let's start with the first one, Lech Lecha, where God comes to Abraham and he says, you need to go on a journey. Go. He wants you to go forth from what you are familiar, to go far away from what you knew, and start fresh. This is critical step number one. If we're going, God says, if we're going to establish our world for the kingdom of God, if to use that expression, of where godliness will become a part of our world, Avraham, stage number one is that you have to break from your past. We need a fresh start. I tried with Adam and Eve, that failed. I waited patiently 10 generations and a man came, Noah. Along came Noah. And again, I thought we had another chance. Start fresh. Renew the world again. But no. Within a matter of 10 generations again, the world becomes degenerate. But along comes one single solitary man, Abraham. And is able to, so to say, set the stage that it is possible for godliness to exist in this world. 20 generations failed at this test, but Abraham is able to do it. Says Rav Hirsch, you know what the first stage is being shared with us? Is that the entire goal that God set in motion for our world to recognize that there is a God in this world, that was entrusted to one person. It was worth it for one person to have that recognition and commit himself together with his wife, Sarah, to commit themselves to be the torchbearer for godliness in this world. Nobody else. Think of the hundreds, thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people. Two people, Abraham and Sarah. This one single Abraham preserves the idea of God in its purest form. That one single soul is sufficient to save an entire humanity and to become the seed for the future, that God can be understood and recognized on an even more global level. So with these words, Lech Lecha, go your own way, Avraham begins the journey. He lays down seed number one for redemption of the world by showing that there is one God that is in charge of everything. That is what Avraham is known for, monotheistic belief. So this is stage number one, the first redemption, alluded to by the final letter, Chaf, by the words Lech Lecha, stage number one. But let's keep going. We said the next letter was the letter Mem. That was referring to the story with Isaac. You see, here, history takes a very different twist. Isaac, who had been brought up on the altar, almost sacrificed. After that story, he begins his own journey with his own wife. But this time, when he goes down into the land of the Philistines and runs into trouble, the end result is not poverty, is not famine, but just the opposite. It's prosperity. He leaves a tremendously rich individual. So much so that the king of the Philistines has to say to him, go, because you're mightier than we are. You're in a better position than we are even. Showing the fact, right, that prosperity and material blessing that unfortunately even provokes the envy of others, God is still there. God is still with Isaac. You see, if you stop your redemption process with Abraham, so, okay, as long as you believe, that's enough. And that's, you know, that's redemption. But does God exist in terms of how I build my fortune? I don't know if God is involved in that. Comes along stage number two, and you have Isaac, who, while walking the entire path of his life with prosperity and blessing, God is still there. God is with him through that stage of redemption, even in, quote, the good times. Oh, but you think, okay, how about in the bad times? How about in the tough and challenging times? Is God there? Is the redemption there? Can man turn to God even in those times? Well, let's go to the Nun. The Nun is with the story of Jacob, where he has to daven and say, hey, God, I'm about to face the biggest challenge of my life. I'm going to face Esau face to face, one on one. I pray to you, Hatzileni na, please save me from the hand of my brother, from Esau. God's hand is revealed no less in the sorrow and pain with Jacob as it was with prosperity and blessing as it was with Isaac. That same God, the fact that Yitzchak calls out to God to help in his good times, as much as Isaac does that, Jacob does that in the tough times. And if you need to pick any of the patriarchs who had the toughest life as far as going from one difficult, challenging time after another, from when he has to run away himself, has to go live in Uncle Laban's house, who's trying to trick him every time he turns. Earn this, earn that. Oh, work for 7 years, I'll give you Rachel. No, sorry, it's Leah. Okay, switching up. And every time, and Leah has the children and Rachel does not. And that brings a certain strife and tension. And then finally she has it and Rachel dies on the way. And then Joseph is taken. His life is not a simple one. Yet what it shows is that the struggles that Jacob has, isn't that in fact the point? In that when the chips are down and things are really tough and you say, there's no hope, I'm ready to throw in the towel, I despair of any hope, it's exactly at that time there's redemption again. Jacob is spared. If you look at the conclusion of each one of those episodes, it ends on a positive note. Yes, it's true, Rachel's death doesn't seem to be positive. But if you know a little bit of Jewish history, you know the fact that Rachel is buried on the road towards Beit Lechem, right, is something that inspired the Jewish people when they were exiled out of the land of Egypt, out of the land of Israel, and it brought them the level of tshuva. It brought them back a little bit, so much so that God made a promise that ultimately, Rachel, your children will return from exile. Doesn't say Leah, your children. Doesn't say Sarah, your children. Doesn't say Rebecca, your children. It's Rachel's. Rachel is the Mama Rachel, as we refer to her. Mama Rachel. Her tears, her cries were accepted by God. And it acts as an inspiration. Yeah. The struggles. When does Jacob earn the name Yisrael? The name that we go by, the children of Israel, the land of Israel. It wasn't at the good times. It's when he fought the angel. He fought all night long. And did he come out unscathed? No. But he won. It's at that moment that the angel tells him, Jacob, you will no longer be limited to that heel. Jacob, the word Yaakov from the word Akev, the heel. You're not just going to be at that level of being stepped on, beaten, trodden on, all of, you'll also be Yisrael. Yisrael is a much higher, a much elevated expression because it comes from the word Kisarita, because you struggled and you succeeded against man and against God. You have the ability to reach out to God in the good times of the Isaacs and in the struggle times of the Jacobs. And that's where he earns it. But now you move on and you say, okay, what else could possibly be as far as redemption? Well, we come to the story of the Exodus. We're enslaved for what was prophesied for 400 years, that we would be in exile. We would suffer at the hands of the enemy. And that's in fact what happens. But what did the pay, what's the double fay? It's from Pakod Pokadati. I shall surely remember you, God says. I shall surely remember. When the Jews were in Egypt, do you think that they felt forgotten? I would venture to say yes. It's one thing when you suffer and you go through a tragedy for a day and a challenging time for a week, challenging time for a year. We've gone through a very difficult time for the past 14, 15 months. Difficult. Unfortunately, many people lost their lives. Difficult. But what if I told you that the harshness didn't last 1 year? It lasted 200 plus years. Don't you think the Jewish people would have felt despair, forgotten? Comes along the letter Pei, and it stands for the word Pakod Pokadati. I will surely remember you. You will never be forgotten, God says. You know, if you look and contrast the first three letters, right, the first three eras, God is seen in the first three of almost being face to face. He talks to Abraham and says, go. I want you to start a journey. He says to Isaac, I'm with you in the prosperity. He turns and speaks with Jacob and says, even in your tough times. But who was God talking to during all the time that they were enslaved in Egypt? We don't have much recording. After Joseph dies, the next story in the Torah is Moshe being born. That's a long time in between. In this version, in this section of history, God is not seen face to face, where he's upholding those who are struggling like Jacob, or encouraging through prosperity in the Isaacs. No, this is only a promise of an ultimate redemption. Hold on to your faith here, God says. This is a whole new level. I always ask this question, and I know I've shared it with you, but it bothers me still. Many of the commentaries point out that the Akedah, the binding of Isaac, was the most difficult of Abraham's challenges. And there's good merit, good reason to think that way, because you can't think of something more challenging than having to perhaps offer up your own child. However, one can make an argument and say, that didn't seem so difficult. I would argue, let's go back to the early stages of Abraham's finding out, you know, a belief in God. How about early on, when he starts to tell people about God, tell people that there's only one God, and everybody's up in arms like, whoa, 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 that's heresy. You can't speak like this. So much so that word gets back to King Nimrod. King Nimrod hears about this and challenges Avram and says, you better stop this or I'm going to throw you in the furnace. I'm going to burn you at the stake. And Abraham's like, this is my belief and I'm not going to stop. And he's willing to let himself be thrown in, and miraculously he's saved. But I would argue and say that was more difficult than the binding of Isaac. Why? At that point in his life, God has never spoken to him. God had never shown and revealed himself to him. It was nothing more than a hypothesis. It was a theory. It was an educated one in Abraham's mind, yes. But he had no confirmation whatsoever. The binding of Isaac, years and years later, he had already had numerous conversations. He knew God existed. Everything was as crystal clear as is possible. And when that God that is so obvious to you says to do this, so you do it. You may be wondering about it, but okay. The first test was a challenge. He knew nothing about God personally yet. It was a theory. That's much harder to do than when you know definitively there's a God and he tells you to do something. But the answer that's given is that while it may be true that it was a theory, it was a logical corollary of his theory. If it's true that God does exist, and that's what Abraham believes, and there's one God, and this God has a role in my life, and God has a plan, and blah, yeah, you know, you play out the whole theory, then logically in his head, it makes sense that I should be willing to offer my life for God's name. It's a logical conclusion. You stand up for a principle, you stand up for your principle, you know, for your ethics, for your values. And if there's a God, then I'm willing to, that makes logical sense. Bringing your child up on the altar is illogical. It makes no sense in your theory. God was promised Abraham that he's going to have a child. And through that child, he's going to form a nation. And now you're telling me to go sacrifice him? One of two things, God, either you're nuts or I'm nuts. It's going to be one of those two things. Either you're crazy or I'm crazy. But that can't be what you asked me to do. It makes no sense. And what about all of the hundreds, maybe thousands of people who Abraham's been talking to and has convinced them there's a God, and now all of a sudden he's going to bring his kid as a sacrifice? It's illogical. The Jewish people, in the midst of the harsh Egyptian slavery, must have wondered, did God forget about us? I haven't heard anything. Not in a year, not in 10 years, in over 200 years, I haven't heard from him. God says, I will never, ever, ever forget you. Here, for many centuries, there was no discernible sign of any redemption on the horizon. But listen to this, ladies and gentlemen. What makes stage number 4 with the letter pay, pakod pakadati, I shall always and surely remember you? How much of a turnaround, how quick of a turnaround did we go from rags to riches? It was almost overnight. We were enslaved for hundreds of years. And all of a sudden, some dude comes on the scene and says, here we go, folks, we are out of here. And the whole world is turned upside down. Blood, frogs, all the plagues, splitting of the, they leave. Pharaoh's looking for the, it's almost instantaneous. Let me paint the picture for you. If I came to you in February of 2020, and I told you what was upcoming for the next 14 months, first of all, you would have said, you're smoking something, dude. There's no, something's very wrong here, right? So, but even if you believed me, would you have believed me to the extent of how many people died from a virus? Yeah. The world was turned upside down in a year. Like that. Instantaneously done. This is the reverse. Enslavement for hundreds of years, harsh labor, hundreds of thousands killed, babies. And it changed like that. This is a whole new way. Suddenly, out of nowhere, out of the gloom of night, Rabbi Hirsch writes, there breaks forth the light of the Jewish people's deliverance. Boom! Moses is on the scene. Egypt turns upside down. We walk out, heads held high, with all of their money, by the way. Yeah, you would have predicted that two years earlier. Not only were we getting out, which nobody even thought about, but we were going to go out rich, heads held high. Yeah, sure. I'm the one who's smoking something. But that's how stage number 4 tells us. This is that sudden God showing in his mercy, boom, what seems to be the lifeless body of the Jewish people, boom. It's not just alive. It's not on life support. It is vibrant. We are out. 2.5 million people strong going out into a wilderness, a desert. Standing at Mount Sinai just 7 weeks later, and the world is given a revelation that it had never seen before. Who saw this coming? But that's what the letter final pay says, that there are some occasions in our history of where it changes on a dime. Not just for an individual, but for an entire nation. I will never forget you, God says. That's stage number 4. But now, something changes drastically. And we get to the final of the final letters, the tzadi. The tzadi. If you recall, the verse that the Talmud cited in terms of what the tzadi was a reference to Mashiach, a reference to what redemption that has not yet occurred. The tzadi is the future redemption. The mem, nun, fe, chaf, those were all we've seen in history already. I'll just point out before I move to the tzadi, a very interesting idea on this pay. I've already, right? So why would pakod pakadati, this secret code that had been passed down from Joseph to his brothers, to his children, to their children, grandchildren, all the way down to Moses, everybody knew this was the phrase that pays. Everybody knew that. So imagine I come along, right? I'm trying to think what's like the... what's the expression now? I'm blanking. I don't know. It'll come to me. But everybody knows that the phrase that says, Pakod Pakadati, I will surely remember you, is the phrase that is the sign that the Redeemer to take the Jews out of Egypt was coming. But what kind of secret code if everybody knows it? Right? I jokingly, I won't share it over Zoom because I don't know who's ever going to listen to this, right? But we give out the code to our front door pretty regularly. We have guests all the time. And I, you know what? Brutally, I don't want to stay up if they're out late. That's there. They can come in. We're not here for Shabbos. Here, no problem. You can take it. Here's the code. Everybody knows the code, right? So a guy comes to me and says, be careful. I know your code. I was like, so does everybody else. You know, whoop-de-doo. It doesn't mean you have any greater knowledge. But everybody knows pakod pakadati. So I read something and it really blew me away. Only Moshe knew the real meaning behind the phrase pakod pakadati. Why? Because the word pakod, the first word in that phrase, pakod, has the numerical value of 190. The pay is 80. The kuf is 100. The vav and the dalet are 6 and 4 for a total of 190. Does that number mean anything to any of you? 190? No, that's not how old Rabbi Dave is. No, no, no. Does the number 190 mean anything to anyone? It should. How many years were the Jews supposed to be in Egypt? Total.
400.
How many years in fact were they there?
210.
210. What's the difference between 400 and 210? Yeah, 190. The word pakod, right? Only the true Redeemer who knows the story of pakod knows that this 190 is going to be the point at which I'm going to subtract to show you that I didn't forget, that I will remember you. Only the true Redeemer could have known that the time to leave Egypt was now, 190 early, because everybody was assuming they still got another 190 years to go. It was shortened by 190. Interesting observation. But let's do this last letter, the letter Tzadi. This is the one I love the most. Not because it's the coolest, although it is, but I think it's the one we most anticipate. The others are history. They're historical events, and it's nice to know that it was alluded to each step along the way with each of the redemptions. However, this letter Tzadi, which describes the ultimate end for which all the other redemptions, all the other ends were just preliminaries. This one is different. This one is different. This one, the word for the tzadi was the word tzomeach. Tzomeach means to grow, to sprout. Let's compare the redemption from Egypt to the redemption referred to as growth, sprouting. I said to you earlier that the redemption from Egypt was turning the world around, instantaneously, in a quick, sudden burst of change from night to day, from slavery to freedom, from being beaten to walking out rich with our heads held high. That's not the symbolism of something that grows or sprouts. It's a process. Over time, you take a seed and you plant it. Unless you're Jack and you have a beanstalk with magic beans, it does not grow overnight. It just doesn't. This final step of the truest redemption is taking all the pieces before, recognizing that it were seeds being planted that will take time to actually grow to reach its conclusion. Let's see how this plays out. Whereas in the story of all the previous redemptions, the physical survival of the nation was dependent on God helping him, helping her, just saving us. From this point on, it changes. Because now that the nation left Egypt and it was forged as a nation, with what at its core? What now is the compass by which decisions are going to be made was with the Torah.
I tried to put you really quick. It didn't run. Here it comes.
Okay, I'm back. Sorry, I don't know what happened there. Okay, I don't know at what point I lost you, but the point I was making is that the difference between everything prior of where the redemption came, whether it was quick or for an individual, what changes is that once we receive a Torah, then our redemption is dependent on and conditional on how well we fulfill our mission of using the Torah as our compass. This is this idea that the entire spirit of the law, the teachings, everything that the Torah is what has to permeate the nation over time. Just because we accepted the Torah, our mission is over? No, our mission just started. Well, what's the mission? The mission is to take that idea that there is a God and that there are values, that we live it, we embody it, and we spread it. And that takes time. That has to sprout. It has to grow, not just within ourselves, although yes, but from within us, it has to then be the nation's task to get it out there into the world through the medium of living Torah. People will look at us if we followed it and say, this is a people that has a purpose. This is a people that have a set of values and they stick to those principles. People can and will learn it. All the other revelations were for an establishment that were primarily done with direct divine intervention. God brought it about. God told Abraham, go. God helped Isaac with prosperity. God helped Jacob with his struggles. God took the Jewish people out of Egypt. But now it's our turn. Now it's up to us. God, so to say, handed the reins to us to let this little seed that he implanted within us to grow. And it has to sprout. All the future now are dependent on the teachings. Thousands of years will have to pass. It will have to pass until that little spiritual germ, that seed, will penetrate not just the physical world, but the spiritual world, and it will bring about the ultimate redemption of godliness into our world. But that's up to us. That's on us now, folks. The history of our nation is the history of the effect of Torah on the Jewish people. Rabbi Hirsch puts it even better. Listen to his line. He says, Jewish history is synonymous with the growth of Torah in Israel, or rather, the growth of Israel in Torah. What a great line. It is dependent on this relationship that the Jewish people have with Torah that allow it to sprout, to spread in a positive way throughout the rest of the world. Let me bring it a little bit closer together. And again, I'm quoting from Rav Hirsch. The reason why Mashiach is called a young shoot, a sprout, he writes, is a plant of history, which, in King David's words, were prepared and protected in every way, even before anyone can see it grow. You see, I'm a city slicker. I don't have the patience to watch things grow. I love to plant and then come back 6 weeks later and pick whatever it is I planted. The fact that I needed to nurture it, prune it, pull the weeds, do all that, whatever. Okay, whatever. No. But someone who has a discerning eye will see the growth every single day. We'll go out to the garden, water it, and say, ooh, I see a little growth. And I'll look in and say, I don't see anything. I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah. If you have a discerning eye to godliness in this world, if you have an open eye to see it, then you get to see the growth one day following another day and another day. Most of us do not have that ability. We get stuck and we like to look at history. We like to look at history in chunks, not day by day. We don't have the patience for that. But the truth is, that's what we need. It has to grow. It has to sprout. It's not like the Egyptian Exodus, of which turned the world upside down overnight. That's not how it works now. It's a slow process of growth. The ultimate redemption, however, surprisingly, will take the world by surprise. Even though it's been growing every single day, a little bit here, a little bit here. I'll tell you honestly, I'm amazed. I'm amazed the fact that each of you takes the time. Okay, it's entertaining and it's a good break from your Zoom or whatever else has got going on. But I'm amazed how many people take the time to learn. It's mind-boggling to me. I really do find it unbelievably mind-boggling. Who takes time to want to grow as a person, as in their Judaism? Like, just enjoy your life. But no. People are growing. People are improving. People are getting better. Yes, there's plenty of people that are going in the wrong direction. But on a positive note, think where the Jewish people were in this country. I'm not talking about around the world where it's even greater. But even in this country, where were we 70 years ago? We were hanging on for dear life. The thought that there would be Torah institutions in every far-flung city that you can't even pronounce the name of, in every state in this union? Seriously? If you would have said to me growing up that I'm going to become a teacher that's going to impact Frederick, Maryland, Loudoun County, Virginia, Gaithersburg, what are you talking about? Columbus, Ohio? There's a kollel, there's a day school teaching Torah to kids. You can't even say it was a dream. It was way beyond. It was a fantasy. But that's where we are, folks. Torah is alive and well. Judaism is alive and well. And it didn't happen overnight. It has been growing steadily, sprouting one soul at a time. You get one group here that's growing, and there's another group simultaneously that's growing, and it will come the day, speedily, where all these, each blade of grass that's growing, and you're going to take a step back and say, holy moly, that's a gorgeous field. Look at the beauty of this thing. But it's going to take the world by surprise because they're not expecting it. Nobody's looking at the day-to-day growth. They're not seeing it. They're going to advance blindly towards its salvation. The verse in Isaiah says it on, like, literally exactly this point. It's in chapter 42. The prophet says, I will lead them blindly upon a way which they do not know, on paths they do not notice, shall I lead them to the goal. And then suddenly I will turn the darkness before them into light and the roundabout ways into a plain. I have fashioned these things continually and have never left them alone. We're blind. Oh, where was God in the Holocaust? I don't know, but I know he was there. Oh my gosh, what's good? 75 years later, we're thriving. Not just in this country, around the world. It has now gotten to the point of where there are more Jews in the land of Israel than there are in the United States. We are just at that point. Think about it. 25 years ago, not even close. 6 million Jews just living in the Lower East Side of New York. Yeah, we're almost there, folks. We have to open our eyes and see the growth every single day. It's going to be cataclysmic to everybody else who hasn't opened their eyes yet. But it's growing. Each blade of grass is growing tiny, tiny bit. Day by day, one soul at a time. This is the secret of the tzadi. That final letter, the final letter is the tzadi. I'll end with this. The perfect symbol, and even the state of Israel understood that symbolizes the Jewish people, the one vessel in the temple was the menorah. The menorah is the classic symbol for the Jewish people. But if you think about it, says Rav Hirsch, it's unbelievable. Why? Because the menorah represents growth. Why? If you know anything about the temple, the menorah, if you just take a step back, it looks like a tree with branches. That's what it is. It has a strong trunk with a firmly rooted base, but from which grows and branches out like a tree. Very much with that idea. The menorah, which has, as I said, they have that rooted base, a growth. Now, do you know what symbols are on the menorah? Does anybody know? There's branches. Blossoms. There's fruit knobs, right? They have all these different things that represent chalices, blossoms.
Flowers.
It's all about growth. That's what the symbol of it is. And what's at the crown? What's at the very top? Light. Light. We've said it so many times. Light represents spirituality. This tree that has been growing, it's all about spreading the light. One at a time. One day at a time. We've wandered all over this world for thousands of years, unfortunately. Since the Second Temple was destroyed over 2,000 years ago, we have found ourselves on every continent, in every place on earth. Why? The words of the prophet are reminding us that it is a process of growth, and you need to make sure that the entire field gets seeded with grass and has growth. There can be no bald spots. No patches of unseeded grass. That would imply that there's an area where God didn't penetrate. Oh no. The arrival of Mashiach will be that final thumbs up that we've done our job. We took this last step. We took our mission of taking Torah values and living it, and by living it, setting the example for the world to learn. This is what it means, that eternal, indestructible Jewish spirit based on Torah. That's what your tzadi is. So if someone comes to you and says, what's with the final letters? Your answer is because they each represented a final stage in growth, in understanding of godliness in the world, starting with Abraham, expanding it through the other patriarchs, taking it to a nation that then took the mantle of responsibility to say it's going to sprout through us. Till you get to the final conclusion where the Mashiach, the Messiah, comes and says, great job. The world is finally ready to accept God as the universal creator, master of the universe, and leader and guide of our life. That's the final tzaddi. So Menatzpach is the acronym you must remember because it represents the five final letters representing redemption. Questions? Any questions? What a cool concept. What a cool concept. Go ahead, Robin.
Because you were cutting in and out most of the time, so I know I missed the last letter. You said something like indestructible Torah. I couldn't hear the rest.
The spirit of the Jewish people. The eternal, indestructible spirit of the Jewish people. To take that mantle and run with it and do what needs to be done. He says this, by the way, if you want to explore this further, his entire essay was written for the holiday of Hanukkah, because that's what it's all about taking from the menorah that represents the branching out, but it's the spirit, the light, that is what is epitomized by the lighting of the menorah. So I know it's not for a while, but file it away in your Hanukkah folder in your head and pull it out. So, but that's where he has this essay. Any other questions? Okay, great. Wonderful. Thank you for your patience. It was a long comment.
I had a quick one.
Yes.
I had a quick one, Rabbi T.
Please.
Did you say there are 6 million Jews living in the Lower East Side?
No, not now. Not now, but when New York was in its heyday, there were 3 million. There were 3 million living in New York. There were more than 6 million living in the United States. 3 million of which were in New York.
Okay, two apartments, though. Thank you.
Yeah, but it's crazy. I mean, I'm saying we're watching history unfold in front of us. Just open your eyes. It's happening. It is growing and blossoming faster than it has over the past few millennia. Just open your eyes and see it. It's there. Okay. Next week I'm going to push myself one more class on the vowels. I'm hoping that we'll be able to do at least something regarding it. I will do my best to limit it to 45 minutes and not hold you hostage for so long. But we will do one more class and then we're going to take a break for Tuesday nights. Okay, until after the summer, we'll revisit this. But the Wednesday night class is going to continue through May. So we'll have a few more classes for Wednesday night in May. All right,
Rabbi T, what was the mnemonic again? Because
it's called Menatzpach.
Yeah, can you spell out each letter really quick?
Mem. Nun. Sadi. Pei. Chaf.
Okay, thank you. I'm not sure I had the right order.
I didn't get a chance to, but they discussed, why is it out of order then? It should.
Yeah,
be.
I was going to kind of ask that. But go ahead.
There's a whole discussion about that, but all right.
Okay. Next.
There's only so many brain cells I can explode in one night.
Can we come back to that at the beginning of the next class? Why they were out of order?
Not a chance. We'll see.
Good night, everybody. I won't be.
Everyone.
Hi. Thank you.
Thank you.
My pleasure, everybody.
Thank you, Rabbi T.
Good
night, everybody.